How does a publisher make sure they're singing to the same tune as their readers? The art of the music magazine sometimes feel like a bit of a vanishing glimmer of the past, but there are a few titles hitting the right notes that still take pride of place on the newsstand. We'll find out exactly how they do it today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Back in its early days, Billboard was a publication renowned for its coverage of the entertainment world in the 1900s. Think circuses and country fairs and such like. But it was when the phonograph and radio took hold that its focus shifted to music, and the rest, of course, is history. Today, the Billboard brand is synonymous with the music charts, from the Billboard 200 to the Hot 100 singles chart. In a moment, we'll learn more about the art of music writing with the Times' critic Will Hodgkinson. But first, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with Keith Caulfield, co-director of charts for Billboard, for a chat about how the magazine is evolving through the music world.
We know that some people will only ever visit our website, and they may never see the print magazine. But there are people that really value the tangible object of holding a print magazine and the beautiful photography that we have, where we didn't used to do that. You know, years ago when Billboard was a much more traditional looking newspaper, it looked like a trade magazine. And we made a change a number of years ago to really focus on making it look more like a glossy consumer magazine, but also very business focused at the same time, where it's unique and it's in how we present music to people. And we have incredible, photography. We do a lot of behind-the-scenes video, a lot of stuff that you can find on our website that would originate from a print photography shoot that we do. So we're very focused on both. We don't print as many issues as we used to, but I think a lot of people are in that same situation. But we still value print very much. At the same time, we're also very aggressive about, how we present ourselves in the digital space as well through, Instagram stories and, what we do on, Twitter or whatever. It's all of these different avenues are very important because not every one person consumes news or music in any one specific way. They're all over the place and we have to try to present Billboard in as many ways as possible.
Who is the person who goes and buy a print copy of Billboard? Is it someone usually connected to the music industry, you have the casual fan or the casual music buyer, perhaps?
I wish I had like a super specific statistic to share with you. I don't. I think the general notion is that the magazine is made for the music fan who is passionate about music. And if that music fan who is passionate about music happens to be in the industry, wonderful. But I think there's a lot of people that will just buy Billboard because they were attracted to it by the photography on the cover of whoever it is, Camila Cabello from Fifth Harmony, or, Future is on the cover this week. You might just pick it up and be interested in what's inside. And then you suddenly realize you're reading a business story about, streaming or something. Or you could be reading a wonderful feature that talks about whoever artist's favorite fashion. I mean, we kind of run the gamut of what we cover in the magazine. So I think the consumer of the print product is just the dedicated music fan. And it's hard to sort of define what that music fan is because when you read Billboard, there's kind of a little bit of everything in it.
For those like me who like numbers as well.
There's a lot of numbers in there too.
I love crunching the numbers. And I love, for example, when on the albums chart, there's like the triangle, which means you sell the million copies, something like that.
We have little designations on the charts for the gold and platinum and diamond certifications that are presented by the Recording Industry Association of America, otherwise known as the RIAA. They certify gold and platinum and diamond albums. Totally different organization than Billboard. They're totally separate. We just happen to present that on our charts as a courtesy to readers.
Who is on the current issue or the upcoming one?
Future, the hip-hop artist Future, is on the current cover that came out this week.
The one with the tropical cover, right? The very green or...
Perhaps. Yeah. I am traveling right now. I have not actually seen the physical copy yet. You tricked me.
I tricked you.
You may already have it and I don't.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Billboard's Keith Caulfield. You're listening to The Stack. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here alongside me and alongside the music critic for The Times, Will Hodgkinson. Will, welcome to The Stack. Good to have you with us as well. Let's kind of kick things off a little bit. I guess, people often talk about the challenges for print, whatever it's covering. If we look at music journalism specifically, what do your adventures in printed music journalism tell you? I mean, did you sort of get in at just the right moment? Is it like so many other sectors, gripped by doubts about the future? Is it in robust health? What's the, I don't know, how do you gauge the sort of mood in your business right now?
I think it hit a kind of crisis point a few years ago. And actually, it's clawing its way up. But what happened along the way is that people weren't quite sure about how to turn. Hmm. Now, for my situation, I'm protected by a national newspaper. So my job doesn't really change in the sense that there are albums that are coming out which I have to review. There's always going to be interviews to do. There's always going to be somebody who either dies, i.e. David Bowie or Prince. You know, there's always going to be world affairs pertaining to music, which I need to write about. So that doesn't really change. The real crisis was in magazines like The NME and the now defunct Melody Maker and Sounds, which, you know, we're actually going back a few decades now. But The NME is in crisis because it was very much the kind of student-friendly, left-leaning, alternative magazine which told you what not to listen to as well as what to listen to. And so they would have scathing reviews, absolutely destroy somebody who they thought was rather naff.
And that's always been the best music journalism, let's be honest, hasn't it?
But that's what's died. You see, what happens is that people lose faith when print sales are down and they feel that they're in the hands of the PRs and the music industry rather than sort of, doing their own thing. That's when you have a situation now, which is what's happened to The NME, which is now free and is essentially a marketed magazine, where they'll have the new Ed Sheeran album, and they'll say, yeah, great, fantastic, 7 out of 10, alongside the Fat White Family, who also got 7 out of 10. And it doesn't mean anything anymore. You know, and it's a real mistake that they made, in my opinion. And what's happened is that void, and it is a void, is being filled by some really interesting underground magazines. You know, these aren't making any... The people who are doing it are really doing it out of a labour of love, typically have day jobs to make it happen. But they are championing and also, excoriating music in the good old-fashioned way. Mm. And, I mean, my favourite is this magazine called So Young, which I just think is fantastic. It's, the guys that run it, it's two guys. They're from Southampton. I think they've moved up to London. They've both got jobs. And they do it absolutely as a labour of love. And I met one of them, and he was telling me that, you know, the reason they started is because when they're in Southampton, The NME was the only way that they could find out about the Libertines or whoever it was. And now that's gone, and they felt that there had to be someone kind of shouting from the rooftops about all these great little bands that were coming out. You know, there are blogs and things which are doing that, but something which was tactile and had artwork, and there was, you know, sort of a graphic design element and care put into it.
Well, and was a whole kind of lifestyle. This was always the thing about the great music journalism, is it espoused something more than even just the print product. It was like a how-to. You know, it's how to be cool, how to live, you know, live free or die or whatever. But it was something more, wasn't it, than just that print product. It always did go beyond that. And I guess the magazines, like So Young's an inheritor of that zine culture.
Completely.
The real kind of ground-up stuff. And that's where you find it now, I suppose.
Yeah, and I love it. You know, and the thing is that it's how to be cool by very uncool people. Because music journalists, I mean, just look at their
shoes. Don't break the illusion.
But that's what's great about it. And that's what attracted me to it. I mean, I remember being a kid and going to little gigs and buying fanzines and reading about all these bizarre bands. They just sounded so exciting. And that's what these magazines are doing again. And really what, you know, there was a hole there because there wasn't a mainstream magazine doing that.
We'll come to So Young and some of the other titles you've brought in a minute. But just on that point about, because you mentioned in passing, which maybe is telling, there's blogs, you know, it's open source journalism, it's very democratic, everyone can have a go. That can't fill the void though, can it? True, there's no barrier to entry. People can write posts about whatever they want. Do you worry that, you know, that traditional music journalism, where there is a great editor who's very skilled, probably himself or herself a very skilled writer, you know, they're schooling people in how to write well, in this case about music, but it's a traditional, if you like, journey for a writer to go on. That's not there so much, right?
No, that's
and if
true.
People are just doing it themselves, they're never going to get that education. Is this an era that's lost? Is that a discipline that's lost? Are you one of the last of the old guard?
I might be. I don't know. I'm thinking that I've still got a few more years in me. But I think what's happened is that, you know, it's all open. Anyone can do it. On one level, that's great. But it's much, much harder to make a living. And that's the problem. There is that element of being schooled. But at the same time, there's not that many places. Having said that, there never were. You've got to remember, up until relatively recently, in terms of, you know, sort of 20th century history, papers didn't really care about pop music. You know, I mean, the idea of having a pop writer, you had a gossip writer. I mean, it was really only started in the late 60s, the 70s, and didn't really take off until the sort of boom of the supplements in the 90s. You know, you'd actually have the Observer Music Monthly or whatever. So it's never been a particularly easy way to make a living. I'm sort of going a roundabout way of answering your question. I think there's a difference between doing a blog where there's really nothing to be lost. You know, it's not skin off anyone's nose to do it. There's a difference between doing that and committing, even if it's, you know, something like So Young, which is just a very small print run. It's someone had to commit to that. They had to put some money behind it. They had to go to the printers. They had to work out the design of the whole thing, you know.
Which is in itself, I mean, it's designed for permanence. It's an artifact. It's not like a blog post which can just drift off into the digital either. You're backing your views.
Yes. I mean, I'm, you know, my argument, and I think this extends to, you know, sort of other forms, is that we're going to enter into a kind of post-digital age where people realise what they're missing. You know, it's the same thing with vinyl or whatever, you know, coming back. It's not because necessarily it sounds better. It's hard to really quantify that kind of thing. It's because there's a need for a tactile relationship with music and with words and with images.
And something, I guess, authentic almost is the...
Yeah, it's a hard thing to define, but it's certainly there's certainly a pleasure. And also slowing things down. I mean, don't forget, you know, it's not good for us to constantly be online. And even to sort of have a print magazine in your hands if you're interested in music, which is such a online-friendly world. There's a real benefit to be gained from that.
Well, we know. Scientists assure me, personally, that if you read something on the printed page, it literally goes into your brain in a different way than if you read it on a screen.
I'm sure that's true. It
has to be true, right? Well, I mean...
Oh, I think so. Well, I think you could trust your own reactions of the kind of anxiety of being, you know, staring at your phone all day to the calming influence of reading print. And with music, you know, it's the culture of music which always attracted me. You know, I have arguments with people about this when they say, well, no, you should be describing the cathedrals of sound or whatever you're meant to talk about. You know, I actually think, no, I want to know the stories. Yeah. I want to know where these people... I want to know where they came from. I want to know what's influenced them. I want to know why they're doing something so ridiculous as forming a band and thinking they could possibly make it.
Vander, we'll talk more with Will and go through some of his other magazines in a minute. Just in terms of your background, I know you've always been a voracious consumer of magazines, maybe different music genres possibly, but do you feel the same thing? I don't know, from when you were growing up back home to the music mags you read now, have we lost something? Have we gained something? Is it important to look for these smaller independents, the more zine-inspired titles, to find the sort of the true stories of music? Has that been your experience too?
Absolutely, and I agree with Will. I think we have a lot of like new music titles, but of course more kind of a niche, like smaller titles, like for example, So Young. But what I do miss a little bit is that, you know, I think the mainstream titles had a few problems in the last years. I can't tell you exactly the numbers, but for example, when I arrived in the UK 10 years ago, I think Q magazine used to be like huge, you know, huge sales. I think the sales dropped quite a lot. I'm not sure if the quality dropped that much, but I think there is still a space for a nice mainstream title. And, you know, I'm sorry, I know Will has a copy of Mojo, which I think is actually a great magazine. Again, it's not really, you know, I like pop music and I like electronic music and I think Mojo is quite traditional. But I wish there would be a Mojo for me, basically, you know, for a market like me. You know,
there you go. That's Fernando's call to action.
No, exactly. And I'm not sure, I don't know what Will think, that perhaps the problem with some of the music magazines is the content went to other, you know, to fashion publications. Because now you see Rihanna on the cover, you know, of Harper's Bazaar, Vogue, and she would not be in the cover of Q as she used to be in the past, for example.
Cultural cross appropriation. Is that another challenge, Will? Do you face that day to day?
I kind of think that I think Fernando's right. And you take Mojo. I really like Mojo. I like a lot of old 60s and 70s.
Well, let's talk
music.
About it a bit. What's the edition you've got here? Is this the latest one?
Got the latest edition here. So Pink Floyd are on the cover because they are doing a big exhibition at the V&A. They've got a free CD on the front. And then, you know, having a look through, I mean, there's a feature here on Prince and, you know, a kind of stash of photography that has been unearthed and all the usual reviews and what else?
Is there something a little bit kind of old-fashioned? And I don't mean that pejoratively at all about Mojo. Is that part of the reading pleasure for
you? Oh, that's definitely true. I mean, it's definitely a vintage-looking... But I just wanted to go back to what Fernando said. I think that the culture of rock is a little bit like the culture... Now we're kind of entered a post-rock age. It's a little bit like jazz and classical. It's becoming something which is not in the mainstream but has plenty of people who are very enthusiastic about it. And I wonder if pop has now been around long enough for it to have its own kind of vintage pop magazine. And, you know, essentially what happens is that when something becomes niche and fetishized, then there's always a space for a print magazine. Maybe not a huge circulation print magazine, but there's space for something like that. So I wonder if there will be a time when, you know, the glory days of Little Mix are going to be celebrated. Yes. Why not?
I would buy that.
You're not going to go and do that, though, Fernando. You need to stay here at Midori House for a while longer.
Can I suggest one thing? I don't know if you guys know this, about a magazine called Blender.
Yes.
It used to be an American magazine. I know, I think it doesn't exist anymore. But at its peak, it was quite fun, you know, because, you know, it did talk about rock and pop and had all those kind of funny, absurd lists, like 100 songs to listen while you're having sex or something like that. I miss that. Yeah. I miss that in a way in the music industry.
I mean, that's a good point. What about just the fun? I mean, I know pop has a... Again, if people talk pejoratively about it, they say, oh, it's too frothy and it lacks substance. But actually, there's an unashamed embracing of fun when it comes to pop. And don't get me wrong, lots of the great music writing does that, whether it's writing about death metal or whatever it might be. But do we risk becoming a bit too po-faced? Is that a problem in your business world, do you think?
I felt that when I did this talk the other day, actually. Everyone was talking about the deeper meaning of yeah. you know, of music writing and all the rest of it. And I kind of thought, yeah, but, you know, what about when Keith Richards overdosed on heroin? You know, we all love those stories. And I don't think it's necessarily frothy or anything, because it's also, you're talking about how people live. Mm. And I think it's the same with pop. I mean, a great pop song is an expression of vitality and youthfulness and fun. And it kind of, you know, it creates this sort of, I mean, the great paradox of pop music is the idea that it's totally of the moment, totally capturing that very moment in time. And yet so often, you know, you hear the Shirelles or someone and it sounds as fantastic now as it did back in 1964. So I feel that all this stuff, you know, I think there's definitely space and print for this kind of culture to be celebrated, and certainly not always in a po-faced way.
No. Let's have a look at some more of the titles. We talked a bit about So Young, we looked at Merger. What about Beat you've brought along as well?
Beat magazine, yeah. I mean, this is interesting. This is a very trendy magazine, and this is the kind of magazine that you'd get alongside, you know, in those Soho news agents, which have got all these fashion magazines, which are like a brick and they cost about £300. Beat is a little bit like one of these. And I'm sort of fascinated to know how they do it, because they've had Beyonce on the cover. But at the same time, they cover completely new underground bands. So I'll give you an example for this, the latest edition. They've got 6 alternate covers. One of them features Blondie. One of them features Charlie XCX, who's very much a kind of trendy pop star. But the other, another one features these girls called the Honeyhars, who are 3 girls from Peckham aged between 8 and 14.
Wow.
3 sisters.
I love it.
Oh, they're great. I mean, they sound like they might have belonged to a, you know, a religious cult, and they're singing these kind of sweet songs which have got a slightly apocalyptic folk leading towards them. But, you know, they're just great. Anyway, the Honeyhars have just been signed to Rough Trade. And there they are on the cover of Beat magazine.
So what is that? I mean, that's an editorial meeting that I'd like to be in. When
exactly.
When they discover those 6
How do they get their stories? And also, how do they convince Beyonce to be on a magazine that might have the Honeyhars, who are yet to release a single piece of music into the world? Mm. It's very interesting. Maybe the internet has helped in the sense that it's opened things up to such an extent that it's not unusual for a kid to maybe listen to Little Mix alongside the Jesus and Mary Chain or Cole Porter. Maybe the way that people consume music now has changed to such an extent that mentality, which is very eclectic and not so much bound by genre in the way that it used to be, can be translated into a magazine.
And is there also maybe a degree of that that affects the publisher's printed material? Because you've got a publication like Beat that can have a quite a different focus in print to what it runs online. Those publishers too can be a bit more flexible, maybe reflect those mixed tastes that they're readers/listeners have, and they can say, well, digitally we mean this and that represents what we do, but in print it's something slightly different, but that's still under the same umbrella and that's not contradictory, or it still makes sense to overall model. Yeah.
I think it might be a little bit like the long gone but much loved The Face magazine. The Face had this ability to sort of say, well, if we're covering it, it's interesting and it's stylish and it's worth doing, and so, you know, you sort of rethink your opinion on Take That or whoever they were doing alongside something completely underground. And I guess that's what the Beat are doing. I mean, a magazine can help in this way because of the visual language of it. It's all black and white, has this beautiful photography, these very, very powerful... Actually, no, it's not all black and white, sorry. I must get that, got that wrong. But a lot of black and white. And, you know, they're using very, very good photographers. and it's very well designed. So that all helps. Mm.
So, well, and it's interesting how often that's still relevant. Oh, good photographer, it's great design. It does help.
All these things, yeah. Which we all threw out in the bathwater, yeah. You know, and then suddenly realised that we needed the baby too.
Let's move on as well and talk a little bit about loud and quiet. And I guess actually this picks up on a few of the things we've already touched upon in a way, whether it's the sort of independent street, going back to that zine culture, all this kind of thing. Tell us about this one.
Well, Loud and Quiet, somewhere in between all of these things, because you can find it, it's a free magazine. You'll find it in record shops and clothes shops and, you know, outside gigs in Hoxton and Dalston and places like that. And it's basically a old-fashioned music magazine. And it's, again, it really reminds you of the Enemy in the old days. And so what they'll do is they'll have a lot of reviews and they've, you know, pretty well written on the whole, and they won't hold back. So, you know, there will be a 2 out of 10 for now, but, you know, and somebody will go to town on how much they hate it. And it's like, I always think it's only one guy's opinion or one woman's opinion. It doesn't matter if, you know, the record companies are, isn't it terrible? I feel that what's happened in a lot of print press is that everyone's so scared of upsetting the apple cart that everything gets good review. If it's there, it's good. And I thought, well, no, that's not right. That's very annoying if you want to buy a record.
Does that manifest itself in a different way now, I wonder, Will, than it used to? So, for example, I mean, I'm sure you've probably been, whatever they call it, trolled on Twitter or whatever, something you've said or some band's latest expression that you've taken exception to. Is it a shame that we don't have the right of reply in the print when you'd get the old traditional angry letter from a reader? That, or actually, do you like the sort of back and forth that you can get going these days? Is it just a different means of expressing the same kind of dialogue?
I must admit that I tend to avoid getting into any kind of dialogue with it because I just think...
You don't read the bottom half of the internet?
No, I just think I've written it and that's it, I'm going to move on, you know. And if people don't like it, that's fine. But the very strange thing, so what I will, you know, one sort of trade secret, is that good reviews hardly ever get any comments whatsoever.
That is
it's bad reviews. Yeah. It's always the bad reviews. And so it's like, you know, I've just told you your favourite band is fantastic. Yeah, great. Well, tell me something I don't know. I've just told you your favourite band is absolutely awful. What?
I'm coming for you. Yeah. What about you, Faye? Are you moved to write or tweet? Or how does your displeasure manifest itself if you read? I don't know, if Will had slighted one of your... You know, someone you hold in particularly high regard.
I think I've calmed down recently, but I remember when I was a teenager, I used to send, you know, when I was in Brazil, I used to send, you know, a letter to the culture editor for São Paulo because he criticized the latest Madonna's album as well. So it did force me to do that.
But did you get anywhere? Did you get a good response?
No, I didn't. Oh, it is a shame, and I still think the review was quite unfair. But, you know, I think it's interesting sometimes, this interaction. But, of course, I think these days, you know, people are getting more violent and aggressive on the internet, and I think that's...
Maybe more prone to react. But what about this point? And Will's mentioned a couple of times already today, there's nothing more scintillating to read than a real excoriation, someone taking something apart brick by brick, really going to town on it. Are we in danger of being too sensitive? Do we lose something if we're not allowed to write that, read it, react to it? I mean, that would be a great shame, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And I agree with what Will says. You know, when you pick up a copy of NME, I mean, everything's 7 out of 10. I mean, I hate 7 out of 10. I prefer if it's 10 out of 10, you know, or you know, 1 out of 10. But, you know, it does become a bit bland. And I really don't like that. And just another point, like, say, we're talking about a magazine about pop music. There's another title in the newsstands called Classic Pop, you know, which is probably more for me, you know, talk about the Pet Shop Boys, you know, the Depeche Mode, the 80s. Again, great magazine. But why can't they add like something from this year, you know, the new Swedish pop, you know? So that's why I think some magazines, they need to open up a little bit more. I just would like to force this point on.
Very, very much so. Well, time is short, but let's end. We like to end on a sometimes blindly optimistic note.
Okay.
I feel you've struck a number of those tones already. How do you reassure, I don't know, a promising young student writer who's shown you a review they've done on their own and actually it's got a bit of spark to it? How do you reassure them that despite all of these pitfalls and the challenges of it not maybe being the most reliable income over a lifetime, they should still go for it and pursue the dream? Do you equivocate or are you still as enthused as you always were?
I would say, first of all, you've got nothing to lose. It's a bit like we were saying earlier on, you know, forming a band now, there's absolutely no money in it, so why do it? Because it's fun and because you're going to have a great time and because things will happen. It's a little bit the same with music journalism. You know, if you enjoy writing, and that's really what it's about, it's about writing. It's not about wanting to be a musician. That's a bit of a myth. It's people who enjoy writing and inspired by, positively or negatively, by whatever music and musical culture that they're interested in. There is nothing to lose. And so if you're young and you're thinking, God, how do I make a living from it? It's hard, you know, even people working full-time for The Guardian or The Times are struggling to make a living. Well, don't worry about that. Get a job. Just do your own fanzine. You know, and you may find, if it's good enough, you may find that in you know, as the years pass, you might actually be making a living from it, or things will happen. So I think it's always worth doing in print. It makes a big impact, and it may not be what you thought was going to happen, but something will happen.
There you go. That's a good note on which to leave it. Will Hodgkinson, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks, as ever, to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando, and our editor, Claire Arban. Write to Fernando directly. He's on fp@monocle.com. Any comments or queries are always welcome. If you fancy buying, well, some of the titles mentioned in the programme, head to the Kiosk Cafe if you're in London, Monocle's own newsstand in Paddington, just down the road from here at Midori House. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Until next time, it's goodbye. I'm going to leave you, though, with a track this week. We were talking about what's in the new Mojo magazine. One of the artists featured was Prince. I asked Fernando for his recommendation of the track we should play, and he said this one. It's Kiss.